This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
In which presidential words have economic consequences, again, corporate tax deductions and the macroeconomy, and then breakfast at the Ritz. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 4th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. President Trump was in Las Vegas today paying respects and offering condolences to that city and everybody affected by the events of Sunday night. Among the very many questions that remain is this one. What do you do if you're on a hotel or a festival or any place, really, where a lot of people gather? What do you do now to keep those people safe? Security at big events and heavy traffic areas is already tougher than it used to be. But after Las Vegas, event planners and security professionals have something else they need to worry about. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more now on the high cost, financial and otherwise, of hardening those soft targets.
Keeping people safe at an event is becoming a more and more expansive task. Steve Schmader is president of the International Festivals and Events Association.
Up to this point, we have been trying to keep people safe within a given area or a venue and keep the bad guy from getting in.
That can mean metal detectors, police at entrances, bag checks.
The Las Vegas incident took that up a level because all of a sudden now you're dealing with a guy who is 32 stories above an audience.
In other countries, it's common to see luggage scanners at hotels, metal detectors at movie theaters and restaurants. Russ Simons of Venue Solutions Group says we're already seeing some of this here.
Most, if not all, major professional sports facilities employ a secondary perimeter, extending the staffing farther away from the building versus just at the gates. But now we're having to look at this and say, wait a second, how far out do we need to take that?
And how to do it without freaking people out at venues where they want to have fun. Plus, there's the cost, especially for smaller, local events. Fred Roberts studies the numbers behind crowd security at Rutgers.
So walkthrough metal detectors are not inexpensive. They'll run somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 a piece, depending on how many bells and whistles you put on them.
He says security for events often comes down to what one can afford and what the public tolerates or demands. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Yesterday, the president and the attendant media coverage were in Puerto Rico, which leads me to this, the president talking to Fox News last night.
Well, we're going to work something out. We have to look at their whole debt structure. You know, they owe a lot of money to your friends on Wall Street, and we're going to have to wipe that out. That's going to have to be, you can say goodbye to that. I don't know if it's Goldman Sachs, but whoever it is, you can wave goodbye to that. We have to do something about, because the debt was massive on the island.
All right, so a couple of things about that. Number one, the president is right. Puerto Rico right now has about $73 billion worth of outstanding debt, most of which is already in default, not just to Wall Street, by the by. But number two, it's not like the president, any president, can wipe out legitimate existing debt willy-nilly, which gets us to this. Budget Director Mick Mulvaney on CNN this morning doing what in Washington is known as the walk back.
The president seemed to suggest that he is open to wiping out the Puerto Rican debt. Is that to be taken seriously on its face?
I wouldn't take it word for word with that. I talked to the president about this.
While the immediate needs in Puerto Rico are just that, immediate, water, food, electricity, there is a long play here, too. The finances of getting the island's economy back up and running. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
Puerto Rico's billions of dollars in outstanding debt not being paid back right now, it's a complicated mix of obligations, says Matt Fabian at Municipal Market Analytics.
There are the general governmental bonds sold by Puerto Rico, which is like a senior unsecured. And there are sales tax-backed bonds, electric power revenue bonds, water.
You get the picture.
Bonds,
all these bonds have different creditors with different rights and priorities and pay dates. Then there are the bond insurers. Big mutual funds and hedge funds stand to lose, though Fabian says there are also a lot of small investors.
About 40% of Puerto Rico's outstanding bonds are held by Puerto Ricans themselves.
That's retirees and Puerto Rican community banks. And as to President Trump's power to intervene, here's Brandeis University finance professor Daniel Bergstresser.
It doesn't seem that Trump can wipe out Puerto Rico's debt in the manner that his comments last night suggested.
Bergstresser says there's no legal precedent, given that Congress has already passed a law governing Puerto Rico's bankruptcy and a judge is adjudicating it. However, Hans Humes at Greylock Capital says the president's comments do signal something important about Puerto Rico's massive debt.
To be perfectly frank, this situation had looked bad prior to the hurricane and looked far worse afterward.
And he says it's obvious to most market players now that in the end, creditors will get very little payback on the dollar. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street today and recently, in point of fact, impervious, it seems, to anything. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While congressional Republicans and the White House are working on cutting taxes on American companies, regulators in Europe are going the other way. Today, the European Commission ordered Amazon to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in Luxembourgian back taxes. And one of the European Union's top trade regulators wants Apple to pay billions in back taxes the EU says it owes. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The European Commission claims that Amazon struck a secret sweetheart deal with the tiny European state of Luxembourg. Competition Commissioner Margarita Vestager said that deal was illegal and cost European governments a bundle.
The ruling enabled Amazon to avoid taxation on three-quarters of the profits it made from all Amazon sales within the European Union.
She ordered Amazon to repay more than $290 million. Amazon rejected her findings and said it's considering an appeal. But John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network, speaking from Luxembourg, where he's attending an anti-tax avoidance seminar, welcomed the Commission's move.
It's sending out a very strong signal to Luxembourg that these secret deals with big multinational companies are illegal state aid.
It also brings fresh embarrassment to Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. He was Prime Minister of Luxembourg when the controversial deal was struck with Amazon. British lawmaker Meg Hillier.
Well, I think it underlines how many complex tax arrangements some of these multinationals get into. But it's great news that the EU has shown that even these big multinationals are not untouchable.
In a separate announcement, the Commission said it's taking the Irish government to court over its failure to collect more than $15 billion in unpaid taxes from Apple. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
All right, full disclosure time. You know our CEO interview series, Conversations from the Corner Office? Sometimes we take a little poetic license with the corner office part. Last week with Satya Nadella up at Microsoft, he does have an actual corner office, but we talked in a conference room. This week, I'm going to let Arnie Sorensen, the CEO of Marriott, set it up.
Well, we're at the Ritz-Carlton Central Park South, which is 59th and 6th Avenue. It is a stunning little jewel in a great location, obviously, right in the middle of Manhattan. And this time of year, it's nothing like a run in the park to start the day.
Yeah, did you get up and run this morning?
I did not, because I had a meeting at 7, so.
Last year, you spend 13-something billion dollars to buy Starwood?
Correct.
To make you the biggest hotel company on the planet. Why did you need that deal?
Well, it was a number of factors came into it together. One, it was available. and that's a pretty serious comment, because when you look at powerful platforms in our industry, they become available only maybe once every 10 or 20 years. It's not as if these opportunities grow on trees. Right. We believe in the competitive world we live in, which is changing very quickly with technology companies that are trying to be active in our business, that our loyalty program...
What I love is you call Airbnb a technology company trying to be active in our business.
No, I'm thinking about a portfolio much bigger than just Airbnb. This is Expedia, Priceline, Google, all right. C-Trip, Alibaba, all sorts of technology platforms, which are not necessarily offering an alternative product, but they want to be in the middle of our relationship with our customers.
To get to those technology companies trying to get in the middle of your relationship with your customer, who then is your threat? Are you not worried about Airbnb in 15 years and them changing the hotel business? Is it Google? I mean, I guess you can fight all of them, but you got to prioritize.
Airbnb obviously will be a competitor forever. They've built a great platform, very interesting. Millions of listings, nominally more rooms than we have in our system.
Oh, interesting.
Our rooms, of course, are full just about every night. Yeah, their rooms are not even available every night, so the business model is quite different. Yeah. And their product varies dramatically. I think some of the product is really offered to be cheaper, essentially. Yeah. We don't ever want to be the cheapest provider of lodging services. We want to be a quality provider of lodging services.
Interesting thing to say. You don't want to be the cheapest provider of lodging services.
We're not in the budget space. We're not in the economy space. We're delivering experiences which people can count on and where they want to come back to us and have those experiences.
You are, apart from maybe tech CEOs, you're more outspoken on some of the social and political issues of this day. You wrote to the president-elect after he was elected, congratulating him on his win and then saying, listen, you have an opportunity here to do some great things for this country, but you were opposed to his candidacy. Why are you so outspoken?
The letter to the president I wrote election week or right after the election, and I wrote it first for myself. Now, it was a pretty emotional week for me. I'd lost my mother a couple of days before. Then we get the election that hits, and I think, okay, well, this is not what any of us anticipated, but accept reality. He's won. What would I realistically recommend that he do? And I think the next reason is for our people. And this is why I speak out most frequently. We have about 750,000 people who wear our name badge every day around the world. They are as diverse as any society. I was hearing instantly from many of our folks, what does Trump's election mean? Maybe from some communities, I'm frightened by the election. I'm not sure I could say after almost a year that there's been any influence from that letter. But nevertheless, I think many thousands of folks in our system said, Arnie, we're glad you wrote because it gives us an insight into the way you think about it and the way you might try and use your influence going forward.
So that's the moral case, I suppose. In a business sense, as a guy running the biggest hotel company in the world now, how worried are you about America's reputation in the world, about our openness to international travel and international guests, and the willingness of other companies in which you do a whole lot of business to participate in this economy?
Yeah, it is concerning. We are constantly looking at data, particularly about international arrivals to the United States. It looks like you're seeing folks around the world say, you know what, I think I won't go to the United States today. Now, the challenge, of course, that's not good for our business, and I can't pretend to be unbiased. But even put aside our selfish interests, that costs us jobs in the United States. It costs us tax revenue in the United States. It costs us all sorts of things which are good for us selfishly. And so I don't argue with the notion that we've got to make sure we get security right and we get immigration right. But we can do those things and still communicate a welcome to the rest of the world, because 99% of the folks who want to come stay here present zero risk to us.
You've been in this job 5 years, plus or minus.
Yeah.
Let's say you hang around for another 15. What does this industry look like when you're done?
This industry is a spectacular one. Now, it will become increasingly global. It will increasingly wrap in experiences outside of the hotel, planning for the things you're going to do when you go to various destinations. The technology will continue to become more and more intuitive and prevalent. All of us are wanting more experiences and less stuff. Not that we aren't still interested in some stuff.
Yeah,
we are.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're sharing on Instagram or Snap or whatever, travel and dining. It is the consumption that we are turned on by. And I think we'll be there to grow with folks as they say, okay, what are the parts of the world I want to see? What are the food and beverage experiences I want to have? What kind of design do I want to experience, whether I'm in New York or in Shanghai?
Arnie Sorensen, thanks a lot.
You bet. Nice to be with you, Kai.
The rest of my talk with Arnie Sorensen, the CEO of Marriott, is out now on our Corner Office podcast. We included, by the way, his travel tips. The guy is on the road like 200 days a year, so they are tried and true. You can get that wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up.
They used to say that football was the final frontier for women in sports.
Why they don't say that quite as much anymore. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 19 points, less than a tenth percent, closed at 22,661. NASDAQ up 2 points, 6534. S&P 500 up 3, about a tenth percent, 2537. Lawmakers grilled former Equifax CEO Richard Smith again over the company's massive data breach. The internet, though, went bonkers over a person who sat behind him in the camera shot, dressed like the Monopoly man from the board game, mustache, top hat, everything. Turns out it was a protester calling attention to forced arbitration. Equifax shares up 1 3/10% today. Hasbro, owner of Monopoly, why they passed go, up 0.1%. Bonds pretty much flat. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note is at 2.32%. Come on. Monopoly? Hasbro? You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Acknowledging straight up that the tax code is a complicated beast, and overhauling it will not in any way, shape, or form be easy. One very basic way to think of what the White House and Republicans in Congress are trying to do is like this. Get rid of tax deductions to help pay for lower tax rates for certain Americans and American businesses. The tax code is full of deductions, as you know, including one in particular known as the corporate interest deduction that a lot of companies hold especially dear. So in our never-ending, although perhaps quixotic, quest to make the tax code more comprehensible, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the explainer.
Right now, if you are a business or corporation, you can deduct, come tax time, the interest you're paying on debt you have.
Supporters of the deduction will say that interest payments are an ordinary business expense, like buying postage stamps or paying for air conditioning costs.
Scott Greenberg is with the Tax Foundation. So if you can deduct the postage stamps or air conditioning, why not interest payments? So far, the government's been fine with this because whoever receives the interest payments from a business is paying taxes on that interest they're earning. Okay, fine. But what the government's also done there is create an incentive.
The corporate interest deduction makes it less expensive for companies to borrow.
Jarrett Seberg is financial policy analyst at Cowen & Co.
By making debt less expensive, it becomes more attractive.
So, no surprise, businesses borrow, not just because they need to borrow, but they do it to get out of some amount of taxes.
The system now is biased in favor of debt.
Eric Toder is with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Now, some businesses are very clever about this tax break. Scott Greenberg.
If I am a multinational company with a foreign affiliate,
then, he says, I can borrow from myself, from my foreign affiliate.
My foreign affiliate isn't generally taxed in the United States.
Maybe my foreign affiliate is in some low-tax foreign country like Ireland. So not only do I get a tax break for borrowing from myself, even though I didn't need to borrow, but I save again on taxes because the interest income I'm earning from myself is taxed at some lower rate outside the U.S.
The interest income is potentially never subject to United States tax.
Does every company do this? No. But
this is, as far as we can tell, a pretty common practice.
The idea of limiting the corporate interest deduction would close loopholes like this, but it would also just plain save the government money.
The intention is to raise revenue to help pay for other tax cuts.
Eric Toder with the Tax Policy Center. The government could rake in $1.5 trillion over a decade if the deduction were completely eliminated.
But I think there would be extreme political resistance to it.
Not just from multinational corporations using the corporate interest deduction as a loophole, but there are plenty of businesses for whom using it the right way is really important. Cowen's Jarrett Seberg.
Groups are going to fight hard. Auto dealers, which rely on debt to finance their inventory. You have farmers who borrow heavily for both the costs for planting as well as to buy land. They're going to lobby for an exemption. Banks, whose whole business is borrowing money in order to lend it out.
Seberg says given how precarious tax reform is, it's a fair question whether GOP leaders will want to confront this problem. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Jen Welter wanted to be a professional tennis player when she was a kid. Her coach, though, told her she wasn't strong enough, so she decided to play football. Actual tackle football, eventually as a professional in women's leagues. She is known now, though, perhaps best as the first female coach to be hired into the National Football League, the men's National Football League. It's a story she tells in her new book. It's called Play Big, that starts before she puts on the pads.
I was playing flag football on weekends. The league actually got a call from the general manager of the Mass Mutiny at that time, and she asked if any of the girls playing flag could play tackle. And, of course, they got my name, and I went to an open tryout. And when I made it, I promised myself simply that I would step up to whatever challenge the game put in my way.
Well, one of those things was a pro sports league, semi-pro sports league, in which I think you made like, what, $12 a season or a game or something? I mean, it's not like, you know, you had to have a day job, I guess is the point.
Absolutely. You know, and unfortunately, that's the state of women's football to this day. You know, the owners have the best of intentions and they are doing their very best to give women the opportunity to play. But with no big sponsors and all of those things, you're really relegated to a whole lot of fundraising, a whole lot of ticket sales, everything that you picture maybe a high school team doing. You know, as I say, we got a check for $12, and that was the first check I ever made for playing women's pro football. And that was my fourth season, and it was the first season when I won a Super Bowl.
Let me take a detour here into the idea of women's professional sports in this country. The WNBA, I'd say, has to be probably the most successful female league. There is and has been women's soccer, and then it kind of falls off the table, right?
Mm-hmm. Pro tennis, but if you're talking about pro tennis, team sports,
but I'm talking like team, I'm talking team sports. So what's the answer then for women like you who want neither of those two more popular sports? What do you do? How do you sustain that interest and that pipeline then of finding women and younger girls to come up?
They used to say that football was the final frontier for women in sports. The challenge is keeping them in the game for a long time when the sacrifices start to, you know, challenge the ambition that goes along with challenging the status quo. We talk all the time about the need for equal pay for equal work. And I know it's very controversial that on average, women make 78 cents to a dollar of what men make. Well, let's talk about a dollar to a million. There's no place that's more pronounced than in sports.
You did spend some time in the NFL with the Arizona Cardinals. When you got there, did you think you'd made it? I should say, as a coach, by the way, you weren't playing, but you were coaching at that point.
I think it was so surreal to me to really be there. I had one goal in mind, and that was to be the first and not the last, to make sure that we set an example for everyone that not only was this possible, but that it was a good thing, because I was very aware if one thing had gone wrong, then it closes a door tighter than it had ever been closed before.
It's a good story. Jen Welter is her name. The name of the book is called Play Big. Jen, thanks a lot.
You're so welcome.
This final note on the way out today, regulatory overreach and pure mean-spiritedness all rolled into one. The Neshoba Brook Bakery in West Concord, Mass. offers for sale what I am told is a mean homemade granola, the ingredient list for which, in addition to the oats and the oils and the whatnot, includes love, the care and attention with which said granola is made. Well, the Food and Drug Administration ain't having that. In a letter to the bakery last month, the FDA said that, among other violations within the meaning of 22 CFR 101.4 subpara A sub sub 1, quote, love is not a common or usual name of an ingredient and is considered to be intervening material because it is not part of the common or usual name of the ingredient, end of quote. Come on, man. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 19 today, less than a 10%, 22,661. The NASDAQ up 2, basically flat, 65.34. The S&P 500 up 3, a 10%, 25.37. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.